On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, which is the second in a series of three LNAPL trainings titled LNAPL Conceptual Site Models and the LNAPL Decision Process. My name is Devin Sechkar, and I am your moderator today from Arlington, Virginia. I'm going to cover a few points before we start to let you know how you can actively participate today. This training, like I said, is associated to the online guidance document noted on this slide. This guidance document was produced by ITRC in 2018. Although we will be able to share a lot of information with you today from this guidance document, we will not be able to cover all the tools and resources. So we strongly encourage you to take a look at it if you haven't already done so. We hope it will serve as a resource for you working on your environmental sites. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, or the ITRC, and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Today's training is scheduled for about 2 hours and 15 minutes, and like I said, is being recorded. While we are in Zoom webinar, you are not able to access the live web links in our slide deck. You can download the slide deck from the main course training page under the webinar slide tabs, under the webinar slides tab to access the live web links. In Zoom, you have access to the Q&A window where you can ask any questions or report any technical issues that you have. We will have two question and answer breaks during the training, and we'll get to as many questions as we can verbally. If we have too many questions to answer out loud, we will ask our trainers to respond directly back to that person in writing through our Zoom webinar Q&A window. There is also an online feedback form for you to complete to let us know how the training went today. By completing this feedback form, you'll be eligible to receive your certificate of completion to support your documentation of continuing education. At the end of the feedback form, you will check the box certifying that you participated and submit the form. You will then be emailed a certificate. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of States. We are a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. Our members participate in technical teams which produce tools, resources, and training courses such as the one you're participating on today. If you would like to be a part of ITRC, please visit our website or feel free to contact me directly. On our website, you can register for teams and learn more about how you can be an active member. The full ITRC disclaimer is available on our website. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we do ask that you review the policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC. ITRC is partially funded by the US government. ITRC nor the US government warranty the materials or endorse any specific products. On slide number 5, I appreciate the opportunity to introduce our expert trainers. All of them have been active members of ITRC's LNAPL team over the years. Not only do they serve as volunteer trainers for ITRC, they have dedicated many hours to develop this guidance document. A special thank you to all of them for participating today. If you would like to read more about their expertise, you can access their bios at the link at the bottom of the page. You can also access it in the related link section by clicking on CLUIN training page. And then from the training page that you registered with, you go there and then the tab for the webinar presenters. With that, we're gonna move to the next slide and I will pass it on to Tom Fox.
Let's see, I believe I have control now, Devin.
I think so.
All right. For some reason, I'm not seeing the control buttons, but that's okay. Let's see if it works. And no.
No. Sorry. Try clicking the screen one more time. It says that you're controlling, but it might have buffered. I see you moving my arrow.
Well, yeah, I can move the cursor, but for some reason, I can't seem to advance the slides.
Try your keyboard buttons on your computer.
I have. They're not working. Sorry. Okay.
That is all right.
Our first glitch of the day.
Try this.
Okay. Well, here we go. Okay. So again, to echo Devin, welcome everybody. This is part two of the three-part LNAPL internet-based training that we offer. You can always visit the ITRC website to get the entire document. The document is useful for just about any size or type of hydrocarbon site. The important part for the document is that it covered four important keys that are written at the bottom of the slide here. We have expanded the LNAPL key concepts. There are nine of them that we covered last week. We have also integrated the LCSM or LNAPL conceptual site model into the document so that it's not a separate document anymore. We have put an emphasis in identifying SMART objectives, and SMART stands for specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and time-bound objectives. And we're going to cover that a little bit more later. We've also expanded the LNAPL transmissivity and the NSED sections with appendices because there seemed to be much more of an interest in covering those topics in much more detail. Did I do that or did you, Devin?
You did that. So I think it's working now.
Okay. All right. So here are the three parts to our training series. And basically, last week we covered the behavior of LNAPL and its sciences behind that behavior in order for you to understand and apply that knowledge at your sites. Today, as I mentioned, we're going to be going into some detail on the LNAPL conceptual site model or the LCSM in order to identify LNAPL concerns. And we're also going to be working with helping you to inform the stakeholders, not only your client, but the public, about how you go about this decision-making process to come up with reasonable strategies to deal with the hydrocarbon contamination you probably have. Next week, we're going to be going through part three, and we'll be going through remedial technologies that can achieve the objectives that you're setting for yourself or your client. Or the stakeholders. We'll also be working on how to transition between LNAPL strategies or technologies as a site moves through investigation and through cleanup and hopefully closure. And then we're going to smartly measure progress toward an identified technology-specific endpoint. So part one last week, we basically covered five key points, and they are that LNAPL does not sit like a pancake on the water table, that LNAPL in a well does not mean that it's migrating or even recoverable, that LNAPL transmissivity is a better indicator of recoverability than LNAPL thickness in a well. Fourth, that LNAPL may be present in the subsurface, even if it doesn't appear in monitoring wells, and it can cause long-term compositional concerns. And lastly, that biological processes play a large part in LNAPL depletion, and these have not really been appreciated much until recently. So one thing I want to really emphasize is it's very important for you to use and understand the LNAPL science that we're presenting and apply it to your site to make good decisions. Our three-part training course focuses on helping you to connect the science, as I've talked about, build your conceptual site model, and also select and implement remedial technologies. What's really missing in this picture is that you then need to apply this knowledge at your LNAPL site. And so today we're going to launch into talking about the LNAPL conceptual site model, which is covered in section 4 and 5 of the document. So we're going to be trying to answer the question, do you know where your LNAPL is and how you're going to address your concerns? This is a copy of the LNAPL conceptual site model process diagram from the document, figure 4-1. In relation to the process flow diagram we'll be covering today, that you're going to show how to develop a living LCSM and how that enables you to make better LNAPL remediation and management decisions by discussing key LNAPL and site data for the model, when and why those data may be important, and how to effectively organize the data into an LCSM. We're also going to be discussing how to develop a site strategy by using the LCSM to identify and classify your concerns, establish remedial goals to address those concerns, and then develop remediation objectives, which we'll be covering in part 3. All right, we have a brief poll here, and Devin, you're in charge. So we would appreciate if you could answer or choose one of the three answers to this question. The question being, the projects I work on are limited by budget constraints. I have sufficient time and technical understanding of how goals could be achieved. Technical constraints, site characteristics limit the effectiveness of technologies and our ability to reduce the impacts, or you have a time constraint. There's a time driver which limits the available approaches to address the goals you have in mind. Devin, I can't see the results, so I'll rely on you to mention when it's time to close it out and we can look and see how people voted. Okay, so here are the results we have. We're about evenly split between budget and technical constraints, which given today's environment, doesn't surprise me that budget is a bit of a concern. Technical constraints are certainly something that we're trying to help you with here in this three-part internet-based training series. And time constraints we'll probably address, but time is often an issue, especially when property transactions are in play. So we'll close that out. And Devin, I'll let you advance to the last slide, I believe, or this is Matt Rousseau with GHD. I'll introduce him. And Matt, it's all yours.
Yeah, thanks so much, Tom. All right, let's start by talking about what is probably the most foundational part of managing LNAPL sites, namely the LNAPL conceptual site model or the LCSM. The LNAPL update document defines the LCSM as the collection of information that incorporates key attributes of the LNAPL body with site setting and hydrogeology to support site assessment and corrective action decision-making. As Tom mentioned, you can think of the LCSM as a living thing that will continuously evolve throughout the site management process with different focus at different times. Figure 4-1 from the LNAPL 3 document shown here illustrates these different stages along with their interdependence. As you can see, this framework is not linear, and a typical project will have a lot of back and forth in order to get to an effective management strategy. The idea here is not to be prescriptive, but rather to lay out a standardized thought process that will hopefully assist in getting over some of the challenges identified in our first poll. I'll also point out that this diagram is color-coded to allow quick reference to the section of the LNAPL 3 document that corresponds to whatever stage you are dealing with at any given time. We will focus today on the first two stages of LCSM development, the initial LCSM and the remedy selection LCSM. These stages help us get at the why and how of remediation. The actual implementation, operation, and conclusion of a site remedial or management strategy is addressed in the design and performance LCSM, which will be the focus of the final installment of our three-part series. Okay, let's break this decision-making process down to its core element and simplify things a bit here. We can see that the main objective of the initial LCSM is to establish what the site-specific concerns are that might require remediation. The remedy selection LCSM then shifts from the identification of concerns to the selection of remedial and/or control options that are technically appropriate and therefore have the potential to actually address those concerns. And I should just mention that although we are showing data collection and decision-making as separate considerations, they are really parallel paths. I'm sure you can appreciate that data collection and decision-making are very much intertwined, and each stage of the LCSM may involve a repetitive cycle of going between the two before all the questions that need to be answered are in fact answered. I mentioned that the initial LCSM is focused on identifying the concerns that will drive the site management strategy. So what type of concerns might we have to deal with? The possible concerns at LNAPL sites will fall into one of the categories shown here: risk and safety, migration, mobile LNAPL occurrence in wells, or other. Risk and safety concerns are pretty well understood and relate to potential exposure of receptors to chronic health or acute safety risks associated with the LNAPL. Examples of these concerns include potential human health issues due to vapor intrusion or groundwater ingestion, or safety issues such as explosivity. Migration concerns may exist where an LNAPL body has not stabilized and therefore has the ability to move into areas that aren't already contaminated. LNAPL occurrence in a well will largely be a regulatory-driven concern. This will cover remedial obligations that may be applicable in a given jurisdiction by virtue of the observation of measurable LNAPL thickness in a well, regardless of whether concerns related to risk or migration potential exist or not. The other category is where the concerns that don't fit neatly into one of our previous three reside. Examples of other concerns might be related to sheen formation on surface water or aesthetic concerns such as odors, etc. Now, you may have more than one of these concerns to contend with at a given LNAPL site, which may require a more complicated strategy. We will consider the idea of scalability of the LCSM and the associated strategy more in a bit. So we've established that the initial LCSM is focused on identifying concerns. It's worth taking a minute here to consider how the identification of concerns at LNAPL sites may be different today than what we have been more used to historically. One of the main concerns we will have is with the possibility of petroleum vapor intrusion. Now, this is not a new concept, but what is new is the significantly smaller separation distances that are now accepted to represent a safe condition. Both the ITRC and US EPA have contemporary guidance on this that is based on large empirical data sets, as opposed to being based on models that did not historically account for the bioattenuation of vapors adequately. Another challenge is the evaluation of LNAPL mobility and the related feasibility and value of LNAPL recovery. It is now widely accepted that LNAPL transmissivity represents a much better metric in this regard because it allows a standardized science-based approach. Conversely, we now know that the significance we placed on in-well LNAPL thickness as a reliable indicator of LNAPL mobility and recoverability will be misplaced at many, if not most, sites. We have also come to realize the ubiquity and significance of the biodegradation of the LNAPL itself, referred to as natural source zone depletion, or NSCD. This has a lot of implications in LNAPL site management, including its role in long-term LNAPL body stability, and what we perceive to be effective and sustainable site management strategy. Other recent improvements in this area include our understanding of sheen formation and mitigation and the evaluation of TPH risk, both of which are addressed in more recent ITRC guidance. Okay, so now that we've touched on the key areas where we've seen scientific advancements affecting LNAPL site management, let's get a bit more specific about minimum information requirements for the initial LCSM. We can begin by considering the basic point that the initial LCSM is complete when we have enough information to inform the requisite decision-making. While this will be very site-specific, there will be certain basic information that will be needed for all LNAPL sites. First off, the identification of LNAPL in wells will often be the most obvious indicator that we have an LNAPL site. This will be important at all sites since it will often be a trigger for certain regulatory requirements relating to site characterization and remediation. Our other needs include an understanding of receptors and potential exposures and whether the current LNAPL extent is stable or may expand. Other items that may be needed depending on site complexity include things like hydraulic conductivities and getting a detailed picture of the distribution of the LNAPL and related dissolved and vapor phase plumes. These may not be needed at simple sites where a prescriptive remedy such as excavation is anticipated. At more complex sites, these items may be part of the initial LCSM or might make more sense as considerations at the remedy selection stage. So how do we get the information we need to fulfill our basic data needs? The list of questions shown here can help. These questions are consistent across many contemporary LNAPL guidance documents and will apply at all LNAPL sites regardless of the level of complexity. So the questions are the same site to site. But what can be very different is the level of detail we go to and the sophistication of the tools we use to answer these questions. The level of detail needed for the initial LCSM can be guided conceptually by the figure shown here. I should note that these tiers are not intended to be prescriptive, nor are they well-defined. They are simply intended to help to set expectations of what might be required on a site-specific basis. For example, a Tier 1 site might be a very simple site with a relatively homogeneous geology, an older or non-volatile LNAPL type, and no exposure concerns. A site like this may not require a lot of work to build the LCSM to the point that an effective remedial strategy can be developed. However, a Tier 3 site might be a site with complex geology, a higher risk LNAPL type, and close proximity to receptors. This type of site is likely to require a lot more work using more sophisticated tools and multiple lines of evidence compared to our Tier 1 site. Let's look at some examples to illustrate this in a bit more detail. For our Tier 1 site, let's assume we have a diesel LNAPL in sand. So we have an LNAPL type that is not typically associated with a PVI issue, and we have no receptors that might be affected. We have a dissolved plume that is contained on site and MNA is occurring. This suggests the LNAPL is probably stable, and the LNAPL transmissivity results and length of time that the LNAPL has been in the ground support that this is likely the case. We may not need any more information at this site to move on to remedial selection. On the other hand, our Tier 3 site has a gasoline and soil underlain by fractured red bedrock, so a much more volatile and soluble LNAPL type in a much more complex geology. To make matters worse, we also know that we have LNAPL off-site in an old well showing dissolved impacts that is screened across the soil bedrock interface. This site is likely to require a lot more work to understand where the LNAPL is and where the impacts noted in this well are actually coming from in order to be able to appropriately target a remedial strategy. For example, nested wells are likely needed to understand whether the observed dissolved phase impacts are originating through pore surface completion or the bedrock aquifer, whereas nested wells are unlikely to be needed or provide added value in our Tier 1 example. Okay, let's break for a knowledge check here, and I would like you to let me know how you would finish this statement. The concept of continually updating the LCSM throughout the remedial process means A, the LCSM should become increasingly complex throughout the remedial process, B, even if performance monitoring indicates progress toward endpoints, better check between borings to ensure uniform treatment, C, reinvestigate with the latest tools as new characterization technologies evolve, or D, the LCSM is updated to inform decisions throughout the project. Each decision point may require different data. And perhaps we can see the results.
Matt, I'm going to give it one more second just so we get a higher participation number.
Sure. Okay, so we see the results here. It looks like 95% overwhelming support of answer D, which is the correct answer. You know, we talked about the scalability of the LCSM. We talked about how the goal is to answer the relevant questions, and that's how it's going to be different for each site. It may be tempting to do some of these things that are listed in A, B, and C, but we really only want to do these things when they provide value or have the potential to affect the outcome of our remedial strategy. Okay, let's summarize this section. The initial LCSM can be said to be sufficient when there is enough information to identify the concerns with a high degree of confidence. If you're good with that, you're done. You may need to keep going back and forth between data gathering and decision-making to get there. And there may be some overlap between information that is required for the initial LCSM and the remedy selection LCSM. So combining mobilization may even make sense from a cost-saving standpoint. However, the more complex the site, the more there will be a risk that collecting remedial selection focused data might occur before the initial LCSM and concerns are fully understood, in which case data may be collected that is not ultimately needed or in a way that is not ideal, just something to keep in mind. With that, I'll conclude and I'll hand it over to Eric Kessert, to talk about the LNAPL decision process. Eric?
Great. Thank you, Matt. So the decision process, as Matt identified, this is a parallel process to the development of our conceptual site model. This is covered in Chapter 5 of the 2018 LNAPL guidance document, LCSM Evolution, Decision Making, and Technology Selection. And we really start to jump into the decision-making process when we feel comfortable with answering the question of, do we have a sufficient understanding of our site to enable the decision-making process? One thing I would like to identify is that this decision-making process is something that can be applied to most contaminant sites. It's not inherently specific to LNAPL sites. So that is something for everyone to understand. So over the next 15 minutes or so, these are some of the objectives that we're going to review. We are going to become familiar with the decision-making process and some key terminology. First off of which is LNAPL concerns, remediation goals, which we develop after we have identified our verified LNAPL concerns, and then remediation objectives, which we select in partnership with our technology that point toward the remediation goal. Devin, I'm not certain at this point if... I do have control. Never mind. Some other learning objectives that we have within this brief session are understanding the three classes of LNAPL remediation objectives and or technology groups. These technology groups are mass recovery, phase change, and mass control. They're reviewed more thoroughly in the third part of the LNAPL internet-based training, but we introduce them here within the decision-making process. And lastly, we are going to talk about metrics. Threshold metrics are something that the audience may not be quite as familiar with as performance metrics, but threshold metrics are an easy sort of upfront way for us to evaluate, do we actually have a concern that we actively need to address, or is there another way to evaluate and potentially eliminate a concern that we identified? Performance metrics are, of course, associated with a remedial technology that is being implemented, and it's something that we commonly baseline and then evaluate throughout the life cycle of active remediation. So this shows sort of a broad overview of where we are at within the decision-making process. Right now, we're talking about what needs to be done, and that is, of course, on the heels of the initial LNAPL conceptual site model, which identifies to us, here are the concerns that we have. The next step after we kind of evaluate what needs to be done is how do we go about doing it? And again, that is covered in more detail during the third part of the ITRC training. We've taken a peek at this slide, but it is worth reviewing. The purpose of the conceptual site model is to identify the LNAPL concerns that we have. And Matt did a good job of reviewing the breakdown of those LNAPL concerns, with those broad categories being risk and safety, migration, mobile NAPL occurrence in wells, and then the other bucket, which just doesn't fit quite as neatly in the first three categories. Looking at them more specifically, as we develop our LCSM, we are really trying to identify what are the concerns associated with it. Examples of risk and safety concerns are often compositional based. Do we have a petroleum vapor intrusion concern? Do we have a groundwater ingestion concern? And probably most importantly, do we have an acute safety hazard that needs to be addressed? When we talk about migration-based concerns, we are talking about the movement of LMAPL in the subsurface, evaluating the spread of the LMAPL body resulting in future risks. In the first part of the internet-based training, we reviewed multiple lines of evidence to consider the migration of an MAPL body. Mobile MAPL occurrence in wells is a concern, I think, that a lot of us face in our daily assessment lives. And this really more has to do where the MAPL body itself is not moving, but LMAPL appears in a monitoring well. And this type of concern really speaks to the question of the definition of maximum extent practicable. What is the endpoint that needs to be met when we have MAPL in a monitoring well? Other concerns may be the production of sheens and or simply aesthetics, staining and odor associated with the presence of MAPL in a formation. Here is a figure which is included as figure 5.1 in the LMAPL 3 web-based guidance document. And this kind of just lays out the decision process elements. Again, the first thing that we look to do is identify what LMAPL concerns we have as we are assessing release. From there, the next step is to verify the concern that we have, and we do that with threshold metrics. If we retain concerns, meaning that they did not get eliminated with threshold metrics, we then look at what is the broad goal that we're looking to achieve? What is the change in condition that we're looking to achieve? Once we have expressed that, we, in partnership, go through a technology selection process that will help us achieve that goal. And once we've selected a technology, we then make technology specific remedial objectives, which are complete with performance metrics and ultimately an endpoint associated with that particular technology. Looking at that through the various concerns that we have, again, here are example risk and safety concerns. Let's say, for example, that we have the concern of exposure to vapors. We could utilize the ITRC Petroleum Vapor Intrusion Guidance document to evaluate, does this concern actually exist at structures that may be present near the MAPL body? If we feel that we have that concern, and again, this is commonly expressed as a compositional-based LMAPL concern, we have to identify, well, what is the goal that we are looking to achieve? And from there, again, we go through the technology screening process, identify technologies that are able to achieve phase change, and we would then implement objectives associated with the technology. This process can be repeated multiple times at a particular site based on what concerns we have, but it is a pretty thorough and easy to understand process, and certainly something that is recommended by ITRC when we are managing our LMAPL sites. So again, let's take a look at examples of utilizing a threshold metric to determine, do we have a concern or do we not have a concern? Taking risk and safety, for example, I gave the example of petroleum vapor intrusion, but another threshold metric that we could use maybe tier 2 standards in groundwater. While the compositional issues associated with an LMAPL body may identify constituents of concern above the tier 1 standard, is there perhaps a tier 2 more risk-based screening approach that can be utilized to see if we actually need to actively manage that groundwater concern? Looking at migration as an example, we really want to utilize that multiple lines of evidence to evaluate, is this NAPL body stable? And that is where the conceptual site model is very important. It expresses how well do we know our site, but we may be able to establish that the NAPL body is not migrating based on a multiple lines of evidence approach. So briefly, let's do a knowledge check. Which statement is true? An LNAPL concern, A, always requires a remedial action. B, may sometimes be addressed by testing against the threshold metric. C, is nothing to worry about. Or D, can only be addressed through remedial action. Okay, thank you all for responding. The majority of the audience selected B, which an LNAPL concern may sometimes be addressed by testing against, I need to kind of slide this, by testing against the threshold metric. And that is what we are trying to identify. So moving along, now we're moving along. A lot of, I kind of previously hinted to this, but when we have identified an LNAPL concern, we typically have an associated type of LNAPL goal with a particular concern. Our risk-based concerns are often compositional. We're talking about the dissolved phase. We're talking about the vapor phase. Migration concerns have saturation-based LNAPL goals. And this is also true for when we have LNAPL occurrence in a monitoring well. And the other may, of course, be an aesthetic goal and or a combination of various goals, depending what exactly that other concern is. So we sort of broadly reviewed remediation goals and remediation objectives, but let's more specifically kind of look at them. An LNAPL remediation goal is the desired change in the LNAPL condition. It's aspirational and it envisions a future state. The LNAPL goal, the remediation goal, is established before we choose a technology. And essentially, when the LNAPL goal is achieved, that means that we no longer have that particular concern associated with it. LNAPL remedial objectives are more tactical and specific to a particular technology. They speak to how we are going to go about achieving the remediation goal. And this is reviewed a bit in chapter 5 as well, but we talk about transitions between technologies. We talk about how it is often the case that multiple technologies need to be employed to ultimately achieve the remediation goal. Here are some example LNAPL remediation goals. Each LNAPL remediation goal expresses a desired change in the LNAPL condition or concern that we identified. So for compositional based goals, we are looking to reduce the vapor concentrations, to reduce the groundwater concentrations. For saturation based goals, we again are talking more about saturation. How do we reduce the LNAPL saturation such that the occurrence in monitoring wells is reduced? And or I suppose, more importantly, when the situation is that LNAPL is migrating, how do we reduce the saturation such that it no longer has the ability to continue to move into previously unoccupied pore spaces? Remediation objectives are, again, accompanied with a technology. And the objective states the actions and desired outcomes that need to occur using a chosen technology. Once we have selected a technology, we incorporate our metrics, our performance metrics, as well as the desired endpoint for a particular technology. Doing so, as Tom Fox identified earlier, makes this a SMART objective. And again, a SMART objective is something that should be understood and articulated in any corrective action or remedial action scope of work that is developed. But it is specific, it's measurable, it's attainable, it's realistic, and it's time-based. It basically writes out your plan, identifies what we hope will occur, but also identifies how we're going to measure what we hope to occur. This is reviewed more thoroughly in the part three of the LNAPL internet-based training. But out of the 20-some technologies that the LNAPL team reviewed, we put them into broad categories. And those broad categories are mass recovery, phase change, and mass control. And you can see the sort of active words that are used to express a remedial objective, to abate the LNAPL body migration by removal of the LNAPL mass. For phase change, we're looking to abate unacceptable vapor accumulations by sufficient depletion of volatile constituents from LNAPL. Within the web-based guidance, we introduce and include these ternary diagrams for each type of technology that is reviewed. And the ternary diagram really describes or depicts what type of remedial objective is a particular technology best suited to be utilized for. And I like the example of dual phase extraction because it identifies that dual phase extraction can help you achieve both phase change objectives as well as mass recovery objectives. That's important to understand, whereas other technologies may more specifically just address mass recovery and or may more specifically just address phase change. We're going to review this later after both Matt and John kind of go through the remedial screening LCSM, but wanted to again just identify that after we've selected a particular technology, we identify the performance metrics. These are what we use to assure effective implementation, and the endpoint. And the endpoint is our upfront understanding of what we think a particular technology is able to accomplish. So that is an initial overview of the LNAPL decision-making process after we have developed an initial conceptual site model. And with that, I believe I am passing it back to Devin to lead us into our first question and answer session.
Thank you, Eric. And yes, at this time, we will begin our first question and answer portion of our training. So for anybody, if you have any questions that you want to ask the trainers, now would be the time to enter them. You can also enter them at any point, and we have another question and answer portion at the end of the training. Here, Eric, I'm going to take back remote control from you.
Sounds good.
There we go. Okay. So I will, we don't have any questions at this moment, so I will pause for a minute or two, and if anybody has any, we can address them, and if not, we can move right on to our next section of the training. So I'll pause just for a minute just to see if we get anything in. All right, we do have one question. Is the remedial train concept applicable at this moment of remedial technologies choice? Does any trainer have any thoughts on that? Is the remedial train concept applicable at this moment of remedial technologies choice?
Yeah, Devin, this is Tom. We've talked about treatment trains a lot in concept, both in the part three of the class. So I gather this person has seen it before, or at least part of it. But basically at this point, the remedial treatment train concept is not applicable until we're getting into lining up the technologies that you plan to implement for remedial purposes.
Thank you, Tom. We have one more question. Where would secondary risks be addressed, i.e. methane is generated as a result of biological activities?
Yeah, and follow up with the causes of EI concerns sometimes, and that is true. A lot of times we don't see methane actually resulting in a vapor intrusion concern because it is so biodegradable, especially under aerobic conditions. But that's really part of that identifying the concerns process. That we were going over. I think methane is a great example. A lot of times in the redox conditions you have within the source zones that we're talking about, you also see things like arsenic sometimes. So those things need to be also considered, those secondary effects. Both of those examples as a result of biodegradation that's occurring within the LNAPL body or within the source zone. But if those result in concerns or risks to potential receptors, then they absolutely need to be rolled into that concerns LCSM that Matt just talked us through.
Thank you, Jonathan. We have one more question. Please briefly discuss the distinction between goal and objective again.
Sure, I can describe that. So the goal is essentially the endpoint that we are trying to achieve. Objectives are more specifically tied to technologies. And as discussed, a technology may not be able to progress the remedy all the way to the desired endpoint of the goal. So it's possible that a treatment train approach may need to be utilized. But again, broadly, goal is when you have a verified LNAPL concern that needs to be actively addressed. And the endpoint of that goal eliminates the LNAPL concern that was identified. Objectives are associated with technologies that we implement to progress toward that final goal.
All right. Thank you, Eric. With that, we will conclude our first question and answer portion. We do have one again at the end. And just a reminder for everybody, if you are interested in receiving a certificate of completion, they will be available upon completion of the feedback form. Once you complete the form and click the box that you certify you participated, a certificate will be provided to you. So with that, I'm going to hand it off to Matt, I believe.
Hey, thanks, Devin. All right, we're going to focus a bit on the remedy selection, LCSM, now, because this is probably our biggest area of potential improvement in LNAPL site management. Historically, our understanding of LNAPL behavior and risk and our ability to match specific types of remedial goals to different remedial techniques has been lacking. For example, pump and treat was a common practice that we now understand will have limited risk mitigation benefit at many sites. We also now understand that the LNAPL we see in wells is generally only a small fraction of the overall LNAPL in the subsurface. So strategies based on reducing or eliminating it may not accomplish much in the way of changing subsurface conditions. Correctly directing our focus means weighing additional lines of evidence to establish an effective remedial approach. Okay, let's consider an example. Here's a common situation where we have an LNAPL body that is stable in extent, but we still have sizable LNAPL thickness in wells. So the concern is LNAPL in a well, but unfortunately the concern does not tell us the best way to address it. So in this case, should we vac truck it out? This is a common approach that many will feel pretty good about from the standpoint that it is perceived as an aggressive way to get LNAPL out of the ground. But let's look at this a bit closer. Let's examine what we will accomplish with monthly vac truck events compared with something like continuous skimming from the standpoint of the changing conditions we are achieving. For the vac truck case, we know we have LNAPL in a well at a 2-foot thickness and an LNAPL transmissivity of 2 feet squared per day. If we achieve a drawdown of 2 feet in the well for 1 hour, we get about 3.1 gallons per month or 36.2 gallons of LNAPL recovered per year. With some assumptions on radius of influence, we can use an analytical model such as API's LNAPL distribution and recovery model, or LDRM, to estimate it will take 25 years to reach our LNAPL transmissivity endpoint of 0.8 feet squared per day. If we apply the same approach to something like continuous skimming with the assumptions shown, we can see that we could reach our endpoint in less than a year. So what is conceptually a less aggressive option might actually be much more effective depending on how it's applied and how we measure it. The main point here is that if we shift our focus from what we see above ground to what the associated change in subsurface conditions is and apply science-based metrics, we may have a very different perception of what constitutes an effective approach. Okay, hopefully we're getting to a point where we are comfortable with the idea that the concerns alone do not adequately inform remedial selection and that gauge thickness does not mean recovery will be effective. Let's now get into the basic information we will need to build our remedy selection LCSM. On the most basic level, we need to know where to remediate, how to remediate, and what metrics make sense before we do anything. We can get there by considering standard questions. Essentially, what we want to determine is where the source mass is, what the nature of the source is, and what is realistically achievable for a given technology. Each layer here builds upon the previous question, from the most general questions in green to the more LNAPL-specific items in brown. Let's spend the next few slides thinking about how we can tell where the source mass is and what might affect our interpretation of related site data. At the risk of stating the obvious, we need to know where the source mass is in order to effectively target our remediation. The main things we want to know are, one, where is the LNAPL relative to the water table? And two, what are the details of subsurface permeability that might affect LNAPL behavior and our interpretation of site monitoring data? Let's look at some examples to show some tools that we can use in this regard. So the first LNAPL site we're going to look at is showing a cross-section with a number of different types of material shown here. The basic information we're looking at is the soil type, and in this case, we have a coarse-grained, more permeable unit overlain by a fine-grained or less permeable unit. You can see across the cross-sections, we're showing our well construction information here with screen intervals shown. We have blue rectangles showing groundwater and where the water table is. We have green showing in-well thickness where it is observed in wells, and we also have these red vertical profiles shown. Now, these red profiles are developed using a technology called laser-induced fluorescence. If you're not familiar with that technology, basically what it does is it uses the property of the fact that PAHs in the LNAPL will fluoresce to both confirm where the NAPL is, get a relative idea of saturation levels. It also provides some information on LMAPL types. So it's a direct sensing high resolution site characterization technology. Okay, with that said, we'll move on here and we're gonna look at this location in here in particular in a little bit more depth. So let's look at, just start out by looking at just at the in-well thickness. So if we look at the in-well thickness in the well, and we assume that it provides an adequate representation of the impacted interval in the formation, this might lead us astray. As we can see here, the in-wall thickness is extending well up into the clay overlaying the sand unit. But if we compare that with our laser-induced fluorescence results, we can see that it's very clearly sensing that the NAPL is concentrated at the top of this sand unit where it's butting up against this clay. So right away, we should be thinking we have a confined situation for a couple of different reasons. One, the LAF results are showing a profile that's consistent with that. We have a lot of impacts here, and we have relatively little or none here in the clay. We're also showing an LNAPL thickness, especially in air oil interface or top of LNAPL, that is well above where we know the top of the impacts actually are in the soil. Okay, so if we were to rely on the in-well thickness, we would get a false sense of where the NAPL really was in the soil. We might also not have a very good idea of what the hydrogeologic condition is. When we compare these two bits of data, we can see that the LIF allowed us to really pinpoint where that NAPL is in a way that we wouldn't have been able to looking at in-well thickness alone. Another way we can try to confirm the hydrogeologic condition is looking at something called a diagnostic gauge plot. So this is just a way to plot out LNAPL gauging data in a way that will allow us to tell, do we have a confined condition? Do we have an unconfined condition? Do we have a perch condition? What are we looking at here? We're already suspecting from the previous slide that we have a confined condition. If we look at the diagnostic gauge plot here, you can see we're plotting fluid interface elevations against LNAPL thickness. And what we can see here is that we have a direct relationship between these two data sets. So as the water table or the potentiometric surface goes up, the in-well thickness goes up as well, and vice versa. So you see that we have the positive slope here. This is really the hallmark of the confined condition. This is the typical correlation you're going to see, that you're going to see that direct correlation between these two data sets. So when water potentiometric surface goes up, in-well thickness goes up. When it goes down, in-well thickness will be reduced along with it. So we can see if we just superimpose where our two soil layers are, we can see that we have the relatively stable oil-water interface, and then we have this air-oil interface that is fluctuating in direct proportion to the water table. So a couple great things here. We using LIF allowed us to really pinpoint where the soil contamination was, where that source mass is. Using something like a diagnostic gauge plot allows us to tell the hydrogeologic condition. We have confirmed that we had a confined condition, which we suspected. So right away, this allows us to narrow down some remedial options. So we know under a confined condition, something like a vacuum Hantz technology, something that counts on moving air through the source zone or using vacuum enhanced extraction is probably not gonna be very effective in a confined condition. Okay, let's look at our second example. Our second example is showing a lot of similar types of information, but we flipped the geology here. So now we have a fine-grained, less permeable zone on the bottom, overlain by a coarser-grained, more permeable zone on top. So again, we have our well information, we have our red LIF profiles. And in this case, we're going to look at this location here as an example. So if we look at the well gauging data here, it seems to imply that our LNAPL is all into the top of this fine-grained soil. But if we compare that with our LIF location, which is our LIF data, which is our direct sensing high-resolution data, this really is showing that the LNAPL in the soil is actually perched, or looks to be perched, on top of this fine-grained unit. So when we see these two things happening, and this LNAPL thickness is well below where that is showing in the soil, it looks like we have a perch condition where the napple or the well is actually acting as a sump that is allowing L napple that is actually above it in the soil to drain down into the well. So we can look again at our diagnostic gauge plot. Recall that with the confined condition, we have this positive slope looking like this. With perched or unconfined conditions, you'll have the exact opposite. You'll have this negative slope. And that's because you have the exact opposite happening here. When water table goes up with perched or unconfined, the L-napple thickness will go down and vice versa. That may be what a lot of people are used to seeing. We might see our highest in-well thicknesses at a given site during our lowest water table condition. That's really common. So what's the difference? So unconfined and perched look similar. What's the difference that we can use a diagnostic gauge plot to sort of differentiate? What we can do is we can look at the ratio between changes in water table elevation and changes in in-well thickness. So with a typical unconfined situation, that'll be about a one-to-one relationship. So if you have water table elevation dropping by a foot, you might see in-well thickness increasing by a foot. With a perch scenario, you have an exaggerated relationship between thickness changes and water table elevation fluctuations. So this case here is a perfect example of that. Instead of that one-to-one ratio, we have about a four-to-one ratio. Okay, so we're getting about a four-foot increase in in-well thickness when we have about a one-foot change in water table elevation. Okay, so that exaggerated ratio between those two data sets is really giving us supporting this idea that we have a perch condition here. So we can also see we have some soil core petrophysical lab results here. This is kind of the first step of soil core petrophysical testing. And you can see on the right side here, this is undisturbed soil core that's been preserved, frozen in the field, sent to a lab, cut open and photographed in both white and UV light. You can see the white light photo on the left and the UV light photo on the right. So the UV light is causing napple to fluoresce, similar to the LIF that we've been talking about. It's the same principle as used in these two technologies. And so you can see it clearly see that we have this napple sitting up in a coarser grained soil zone that's sitting on top of these finer grained soils. So all this information is pointing to perch conditions. So again, that knowing that hydrogeologic condition, knowing where the napple is going to help us focus our remedial options. We know from experience that something like that employs drawdown will not provide added benefit in a perch condition. So we might eliminate things like total fluids pumping or other pumping strategies that involve drawdown from consideration here. One last example we'll look at. This is a bedrock application. You can see our diagnostic gauge plot here. Again, we have that positive slope or that direct relationship between in-well thickness going up as the potentiometric surface increases and vice versa, which is again is a hallmark of a confined condition. You can see at its max here, we have in-well L-napple thicknesses, you know, on the order of 4 or 5 feet. Which in and of itself would suggest a very large impacted zone in the soil, or in this case, in the bedrock. But again, if we take our more basic data like diagnostic gauge plot, well gauging data, and compare it against something a little bit more sophisticated like a conductivity profile, we can see that the zone that this L-napple is coming from, or the zone where we seem to see it in the wells, coincides with a very small reduction in conductivity, which is associated with a fracture here in the bedrock. So again, if we just looked at the diagnostic gauge plot, we might think we had a quite extensive impacted zone in this bedrock or soil, as the case may be. But using something like a conductivity profile allows us to really pinpoint that this is coming from a small fracture, which obviously may lead to a very different remedial strategy than if we had a larger contaminated zone. Okay, let's summarize our examination of the question of where the source is here. Certain types of characterization data lend themselves more or less to certain remedial applications. For example, data relating to where the L-napple is and soil permeability help determine where injection or gradient-driven technologies might target. In addition, data that help identify hydrogeologic condition and where the El Napo is relative to the water table can help screen what techniques may be appropriate and which are unlikely to be successful. If we need to get a detailed picture of El Napo distribution, we are fortunate to have a number of options available to us, all of which are discussed in the El Napo 3 document. And if you are faced with El Napo in a fractured rock environment, there is great information for this specific and complicated scenario in the fractured rock appendix to the El Napo 3 document, as well as the standalone ITRC fractured rock guidance. That concludes our consideration of where the source mass is. I'll now pass the torch to John Smith from AECOM to look at the nature of the source.
All right, thanks, Matt. So yeah, really good overview there on the first remedy selection question, determining where we should be targeting our remediation. So yeah, like Matt said, now we're gonna move on to our second question, talk a little bit about the nature of the source. And with this question, we're kind of starting to move into, you know, we think about how we might be able to target that source material, or what kind of remedial mechanisms are likely to be effective in helping us achieve our goals. Oh, whoops, too far. Okay, I think I got it. All right, so Devin, if we could open the poll here. Kicking things off with a poll to gauge everyone's level of experience with El Napo transmissivity. So this is something we'll be touching on throughout the training today. It's often an aspect of our El Napo sites that we want to understand. You know, we want to know whether or not the El Napo is recoverable, and this is one of the best tools that we have for evaluating that. I think we talked about it a little bit in part one of the training. You know, Matt gave us a great example today of how we can use this to help evaluate different recovery technologies. Like I said, we'll be talking about it more and more as we go today. There we go. Okay. All right. So yeah, it looks like there's a pretty decent mix of experience with El Napo transmissivity in the class, similar to what we've seen in other classes. I think no matter where you are with respect to your El Napo transmissivity experience, I think the material that we're going to cover today, it does a pretty good job of addressing a range of experience levels. So we can close the poll, or I can close it maybe, yeah. Slide, okay. So here we're sort of starting to set up a link between different remedial mechanisms you can see on the left and some of the characterization data that we can use to help evaluate those specific mechanisms on the right. For example, you want to know something about the volatility of your El Napo before you can make a decision about what technology you're going to use, or, you know, screening out a vapor mass transfer sort of technology like aquifer sparging or vapor extraction. I think it's important to just, you know, take a moment, think back to the point that we made earlier today on the differences between the concerns and the remedy selection LCSM. You know, you can see here that a lot of times we might not need a lot of these data to characterize these aspects of our sites unless we'd already sort of gone through that process and established that remediation was going to be necessary. So another poll question here. And for this one, we're walking through this example. Here we've got a site, we've got a dissolved benzene concern. Let's say it's sourced from this El Napo body. You can also see in the plan view figure that we've got here, we've got some El Napo transmissivity data. It's telling us that we've got some recoverable El Napo in this darker green area, sort of in the core of the El Napo body there. The second bullet that we've got on the slide here is also telling us that our monitoring data is showing that the El Napo footprint is stable. So the El Napo footprint isn't expanding. The dissolve phase is stable. So our primary concern here really still is the dissolved phase plume. And we got to think about whether hydraulic recovery is going to be a good way for us to address that concern. So let's see, where do we, how's our poll looking?
I'm just going to give it one more second. We're getting a number of answers. So.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. So yeah, this is I think this is a great sort of example to go through. I think yeah. So let's see. We've got some yeses, noes. The biggest bucket is insufficient information, and you know, I think with the information given, you could probably convince yourself maybe that any of those poll question answers are maybe the right answer. But I think probably the best answer is the way that the class is weighted here. The best answer is probably C, because you know, without seeing this site in three dimensions, it's really difficult to say what might be the most appropriate remedy, right? So now we're going to look at a more complete picture of this site. We've got, this new visuals showing us the LNAPL distribution in three dimensions. You can see that we've got mobile, potentially recoverable LNAPL that's present within a fairly narrow 1 to 2 foot interval near the water table. But we've got residual LNAPL that extends about 30 feet above the water table and about 60 feet below. So maybe think back a little bit. Eric talked earlier about the difference between our saturation and composition goals. Maybe also think about some of the content in part one about Raoult's law. We talked about how you can reduce LNAPL saturation, and oftentimes that doesn't have a dramatic effect, at least not for a long time, on the groundwater quality concern, right? So we could implement some kind of hydraulic recovery here, and maybe we can reduce that LNAPL saturation within that 1 to 2 foot interval where we've got mobile LNAPL. Let's say we reduce that by 10%, but even after we remove that recoverable fraction, we still have a residual fraction in contact with the groundwater in that zone. And more importantly, that hydraulic recovery isn't going to do anything to address the residual in contact with groundwater beneath the mobile interval. So, I think this is a really, it makes this sort of concept really stand out, this site where we've got this pretty large smear zone. It's generally, this sort of thought process is good. It's good practice to think about how these same concepts would apply for your smaller sites, right, too. You can see in the green text at the bottom of the slide here, we've got an example that's sort of scaled back to represent a smaller release. And, the relative difference between that vertical extent of the mobile and the residual smear zone, it's not as pronounced, but still understanding that distribution, where there's mobile, where there's residual, plays a really important role when it comes to selecting a remedy that's going to address, in this case, a dissolved phase concern. So we're going to talk about this more as we go today, but this is sort of a short overview, a kickoff on LNAPL transmissivity. It tells us really what we're looking for is some information about the mobile and the residual LNAPL fraction. So here we've got a short summary, some of the backup information that was used and put forward in the 2009 ITRC LNAPL guidance document. Maybe to put that range in context, we can start by sort of highlighting the fact that there's a connection between LNAPL saturation and transmissivity. As we decrease the amount of LNAPL in the soil pore space, the transmissivity decreases, right? And when LNAPL gets to residual saturation, the LNAPL transmissivity is zero, because at residual saturation, by definition, the LNAPL doesn't flow under an applied gradient anymore. Now you can kind of think of a scenario where we've got a very low LNAPL transmissivity. This represents an LNAPL saturation that's slightly above that residual. And keep in mind, like as you get closer and closer to residual, it gets harder and harder to remove the LNAPL, right? It's going to come out more slowly, regardless of how hard you're trying. as that saturation falls. The lower the saturation, the lower the transmissivity, the longer it takes to reduce the fraction any further. That's really what that 0.1 to 0.8 range is representing for us. So and keep this in mind. We'll circle back to it later. For now, we're going to change it up a little bit, spend some time on some other remedial mechanisms. So on this slide, we've got some examples of data that we can use to infer composition of the elm apple. And we're introducing this bar chart along the bottom of the slide. We'll see more of that in some of the upcoming slides. And really this bar chart, it's sort of intended just to give us a really high level summary of what we get from maybe a more sophisticated laboratory analysis of the elm apple using gas chromatography. This is something we'll be using and referring back to as we go. Moving from left to right, we're getting into heavier elm apple compositions in general. So here we've got a chromatogram. This is for a gasoline. And you can see as we move along the x-axis on this this chromatogram, the chart from left to right, the hydrocarbon compounds are increasing in boiling point, and that correlates nicely to the molecular weight or the size of the compounds. And along the y-axis, the area under the peaks has given us a pretty good estimate of the relative mole fraction of the individual hydrocarbon constituents in the elm apple. So here we've overlaid some of the names of the individual constituents that are identified on those peaks. You can get a sense here of just how much, really good detail we could extract from these chromatograms. But this is maybe a little bit in the weeds. We don't necessarily need to focus on all that detail today. Really, we want to use this to distinguish between, different ranges that are going to help us with remedy selection. You look at a chromatogram like this, we've got a lot of peaks concentrated in the gasoline range. That helps us, gives us a clue that, vapor phase mass transfer remedies might be effective at a site like this. As long as we keep in mind what we just covered in, the where is the source question, right? We still got to consider the geologic conditions. Consider the elm apple distribution with respect to the geologic conditions, and we have to be able to access it. For example, no matter how volatile the elm apple is, if it's present beneath a confining layer in the area that we want to address, SVE probably isn't going to be the best technology for us to use. Okay, another chromatogram here. This time we're looking at a fresh diesel elm apple. So you can see there's a pretty minimal response in that lighter, blue gasoline range. But we've got a lot of prominent peaks in this chromatogram labeled with the NC, 10 through NC18. These are all normal alkanes. And those normal alkanes tend to be pretty biodegradable. On the subject of biodegradation, I'm just gonna pause for a minute, touch on NSCD. This is an area where there's been a lot of active research. We've learned a lot in the past, say, 15 years or so. And it seems like the more we learn, the more we understand that NSCD is sort of like this big, unifying concepts. It sort of brings together a lot of different aspects of our LCSM. So, in the concerns LCSM part of this training, we mentioned that NSCD represents a control on elm apple migration, similar to how we might think about natural attenuation in a dissolved phase plume. If you're familiar with the ITRC petroleum vapor intrusion guidance, then that biodegradation plays a huge role when it comes to evaluating petroleum vapor intrusion. There's going to be a lot more discussion on this in part 3 next week. So I would encourage everyone to attend. For now, we really want to highlight the value of NSCD as a nice baseline for, you know, assessing the efficacy of active remedies and as an indicator of biodegradation potential. Okay, so a couple slides back, we talked about alkanes. We said that they're highly biodegradable, and that's important because historically there was a perception that the conditions within LNAPL source zones, they weren't necessarily conducive to a lot of microbial activity. So a lot of people assume that the biodegradation was really only occurring with the more soluble fraction of the LNAPL. So it had to basically be dissolved into the groundwater and sort of move out of the source to really get a lot of biodegradation to occur. You know, there was some pretty sophisticated modeling software that even was developed that incorporated those concepts, right? It was dissolution rates controlled the overall depletion. Once in the dissolve phase, we would have biodegradation. But like we saw in part one of the training, we have lots of data on how the composition of LNAPLs change as a result of NSCD. And that data is telling us that biodegradation isn't really limited to those lighter, more soluble compounds. But we are also pointing out here that biodegradation is really dependent on molecular structure. So in general, you know, the straight chain, like we said, the saturated normal alkanes tend to be highly biodegradable, while more branched hydrocarbons tend to be more difficult for microbes to utilize. So here we're going to compare the relative efficacy of three different remedial mechanisms as a function of composition. So to start, here we're looking at relative vapor pressure. These are highlighting the different petroleum ranges along the x-axis, and you can kind of see, you know, the lighter compounds within the gasoline range. These have higher vapor pressure and would therefore be more susceptible to a vapor phase mass transfer mechanism. Next, we're adding some of these relative biodegradation rate constants in the green bars, and you can see that there's a lot less variability in the biodegradation potential across that range. And finally, we're adding a relative solubility in light blue here. And again, I don't know if I remembered to point this out at the beginning, but all of these values are normalized to naphthalene, right? So the vapor pressure is normalized to the vapor pressure of naphthalene. Biodegradability normalized to naphthalene. You can see keep in mind that, you know, we're not actually comparing things in the same units here. So we can't compare directly the absolute values, but this is giving us a really strong sense for the variability, you know, for different constituent ranges. So, while vapor pressure is decreasing by several orders of magnitude, all within that gasoline range, and more than that for some of the heavier constituents, the main point here is to note that biodegradability is a lot more uniform across our whole hydrocarbon spectrum here. So here we're summarizing some different types of data that we can use to evaluate different remedial mechanisms or remedial technologies. Could get into this pretty deeply. I'm going to kind of gloss over it for now, but would encourage you to look back and sort of contemplate how these line up. We've got some additional examples of characterization data that we can use to help evaluate different technologies that rely on different mechanisms. We want to keep in mind that regardless of the mechanism we're evaluating, we got to consider the LNAPL distribution and permeability, right? Like the where is the source discussion. This is largely building on that question once we get to the nature of the source. So one of the main takeaways from this, sort of nature of the source module is that we've got a lot of different tools that we can use to look at different mechanisms. We want to be able to compare the expected performance between those different mechanisms and make informed decisions on which one or which combination is going to be the most effective in helping us, you know, reach our goals. So now we're moving on to the third. This is the final remedy LCSM question. What can we achieve with a given technology? And again, like we were just pointing out on the nature of the source, really builds on both of the two previous questions, right? To determine what we can actually achieve with a technology, we need to understand the LNAPL distribution with respect to the subsurface conditions. We need to understand the characteristics of the LNAPL itself. And then even beyond those considerations, we need to think about other things like potential limitations due to current land use or maybe the characteristics of the technology itself. So to start, we're going to do a little dive into LNAPL transmissivity. We're going to look at data from four different sites here. So four different sites with different subsurface conditions. You can kind of see with those bullet points here, we're showing that the average hydraulic conductivity of the subsurface materials varies by more than four orders of magnitude at these four different sites. And the goal here is to give some background again on that 0.1 to 0.8 range and what that means with respect to the LNAPL recovery performance that we can expect and what it means about the fraction of mobile and residual LNAPL. So to start, we can kind of look at the bottom of the slide, and we're showing different recovery wells from each of these four different case study sites we've sort of introduced on the last slide. And for each well or each group of wells, we have recovery data that was used to track changes in the LNAPL transmissivity over time. And for each site, the fraction of the mobile and residual LNAPL was evaluated using a combination of different data types. So decline curve analysis, in some cases, laboratory petrophysical testing, and soil TPH data. So to begin, you can kind of look at the numbers directly below that x-axis. So you can see going left to right, we've got 14, 14, 6, 2. Those values indicate the initial LNAPL transmissivity values prior to recovery. So you can see that the initial transmissivity values were generally much higher at sites 1 and 2. And at those sites, the evaluation was focused exclusively on that mobile interval. You can see in the cross section above, we're talking when we say the mobile interval, the mobile where we've got LNAPL from the formation, it's accumulating in wells, right? So this is indicated by that red dashed line on the section. The point is that it doesn't really include residual LNAPL that might be, above or below that mobile interval and that all that LNAPL that's in indicated with the lighter pink halo around the red dashed line. And for sites 3 and 4, so these were, they had less recoverable LNAPL before remediation began. So those were actually, we said sites 1 and 2 were focused exclusively on the mobile interval. Sites 3 and 4 considered the full smear zone. Some of the information that we're summarizing here on this bar chart, all the way to the left, we're kind of focused on this one well 7 at case study site 1. So again, prior to any recovery, LNAPL transmissivity at this well was 14 square feet per day. You can kind of see that at the bottom of the chart there. And now we're focusing on that darker blue-green color on the bar chart. This is representing the fraction of the LNAPL that was recovered from this well while the transmissivity was above about 0.3 to 0.8 square feet per day. And we're also highlighting the time that it took to reduce the LNAPL transmissivity from that initial value to within that range. So at well 7, we recovered about 75% of the LNAPL formation there in about 2 years. while the LNAPL transmissivity was higher than about 0.8 square feet per day. Now the light blue here is representing the fraction of the LNAPL that was recovered beyond that transmissivity range, right? So this is when the LNAPL transmissivity was consistently measured at values less than 0.8 square feet per day. And again, you can see the amount of time that the system was operated under that condition. And the gray here, this is representing the mobile LNAPL after the recovery had ended, right? So this is the remaining LNAPL above residual saturation that wasn't recovered from a decline curve analysis. The granitic pattern that we've got at the top of the bar chart, this is telling us the residual LNAPL. So this is LNAPL that's going to remain and can't be hydraulically recovered, regardless of how much longer we were to pump. Okay, so now we've got all the data together, and you can see there's a few differences in recovery performances at some of these wells. A lot of that correlates fairly well to differences in the recovery well layout. For example, recovery well network at site one was, recovery wells installed on a grid pattern throughout the core of the LNAPL body, whereas the recovery wells at site two were essentially installed along a transect. So sort of a different approach there, prevent migration or, recover LNAPL to this single transect versus pepper the interior of the LNAPL body with recovery wells. And you can see there's a much weaker decline signal at site two. This is the result of LNAPL being recovered over larger distances. And the further away you get from the recovery wells, the less drawdown you have. Basically just a weaker decline signal at site two. But the primary takeaway from this is that the transmissivity in all these cases provides a pretty solid, consistent metric for tracking recoverability over time. And once it's reduced to about that 0.8 square feet per day number, virtually all of the recoverable LNAPL had been recovered. So that's why transmissivity values in that range are generally, we're referring to this as a really strong indicator that most of that LNAPL mass is, it's residual and probably not very accessible to hydraulic recovery. Okay, so that was a lot on hydraulic recovery. I think it's warranted. A lot of times people think about LNAPL remediation and hydraulic recovery is the first remediation technique that would come to mind. But here we're going to look at mass removal potential for, some other mechanisms. Here, to start, we're going to compare hydraulic recovery and bioremediation. So on the left here, we're showing recovery potential for a skimming well system. So this is, you can kind of imagine just a skimming well system that includes a well density of about 16 wells per acre at 30 foot ROI, I think ends up rounding about to that. We've got recovery potential this is just based on the distribution of LNAPL transmissivity values from the API LNAPL transmissivity database. And we're comparing that to the chart on the right. We've got respiration test data summarized from a lot of the work that was done in the 1990s. And you can kind of see the distribution of the removal rates as they're presented. They're pretty similar. If you look closer to the x-axis on the right here and focus on the units, you can see the average removal rates for biovending are calculated on a per foot Vadose zone basis. So if we've got a smear zone that extends several feet above the water table, we would predict that the biovending rates would be proportionally higher than the ones shown on this chart. Something to keep in mind that, next time you're evaluating a mass removal technology, you might consider doing a respiration test in addition to doing the bail down test, right? I'd also point out that the hydraulic recovery potential, this is something that tends to decline exponentially over time, As we reduce the amount of mobile LMAPL, sort of like what we were doing with those bar charts on the previous slides, we tend to see the recovery rates diminish pretty rapidly, whereas biodegradation, it can act on mobile and residual fractions and tends to be sustainable over longer periods of time. So how about the volatilization mechanism? On the right side of the slide, we've got a series of chromatograms, and we're showing some changes in the composition of a gasoline as it's evaporated. So each of these chromatograms, again, are normalized to a naphthalene peak height. It sort of serves as a reasonable representation of the low end of volatility for what can be found in a gasoline. So you can see that as more of the gasoline is evaporated, the relative concentration of most of these compounds is decreasing relative to the naphthalene. And, good indicator that technologies like soil vapor extraction or multi-phase extraction are probably going to be pretty effective in reducing the benzene and the overall, light end petroleum hydrocarbon fractions at the site. What's kind of interesting here is that we can see that relative to the other compounds in the mixture, the toluene is sort of hanging around, right? It's not decreasing, depleting from the LMAPL as rapidly as some of the other constituents. It kind of makes you wonder, should we be concerned at our sites where we're doing SVE that we're going to have toluene hanging around? You typically don't see that. I think one of the possible explanations for that is that we don't see toluene hanging around is that it is also very biodegradable. And when we're operating a remedy like SVE or MPE, in addition to the vapor mass transfer mechanism, we're also introducing a lot of oxygen-rich atmospheric air into the subsurface to enhance biodegradation. So, we're sort of highlighting the significance of that, vapor mass transfer mechanism. Pointing out the biodegradation mechanism and sort of. So you think when you're setting up your performance metric for a system like this, you might consider. In addition to looking at the direct mass removal in the gas phase, also looking at things like the oxygen concentration, carbon dioxide concentration in your vapor stream, and trying to quantify some of those mass losses from biodegradation. All right, so as an example, here we're showing a case study site where a multi-phase extraction system was operated to address a gasoline release. And this is a really useful example for comparing different mechanisms because sort of like that ternary diagram that Eric was showing us earlier, multi-phase extraction, it utilizes multiple mechanisms. And so it serves like a phase change and a mass removal objective. I think you could argue, depending on how you wanted to use it, it could fit into any one of those buckets on that diagram, right? So here, this is a cross section for the site, just to familiarize everyone with it a little bit, showing the generalized stratigraphy. We've got sand and gravel deposits shown in the bright green, finer grained overbank deposits shown in a darker greenish brown color. Here we've got the chart at the bottom of the slide. This is comparing the mass removal performance for that system by the three different mechanisms that we've got. So hydraulic recovery, vapor partitioning, and biodegradation. And after 6 years of operation, you can kind of see there's still benzene in the groundwater at this site, as noted in the bullet here, and that benzene still needs to be addressed. We've got the pull open. We're looking for everyone's thoughts, given the results shown here, what kind of remedial mechanisms would make the most sense to address the dissolve phase concern? And, when you're thinking, consider that the LMAPL recovery was the dominant mechanism initially, but the recovery rates, you can see in the chart there, they decrease pretty rapidly. And vapor phase mass transfer performed really well for the, you know, most of the 6-year time frame. But ultimately, what we saw for the MPE system here, in the end, the dominant mass removal mechanism was the biodegradation. Again, keep in mind, this is a gasoline site. So everybody's putting their 2 cents on the poll. What should we do here? Okay. So bioremediation is the winner so far. I would agree with the people that are answering bioremediation. You know, given the data that we have, that seems to have been the most effective mechanism in the near the water table zone. So addressing the benzene, maybe through something like aquifer sparging or biosparging to focus on that remaining mass below the water table, I think makes a lot of sense. So here again, we're sort of emphasizing this this need to combine what we know about the technical limitations of the different remedial technologies with our site limitations. Maybe, for example, you can think about the possible negative effects of various waste streams that a particular remedy might generate, or maybe consider a site where there are a lot of buried utilities that might be damaged by heat or electrical fields. Maybe we wouldn't be as likely to implement a thermal remediation at that site, right? When we're thinking about, what's technically achievable, we consider that we can apply a tiered approach, just like we talked about earlier today for that concerns LCSM. You know, if we're looking at a more complex site, looking at a site with a greater potential for risk to receptors, we probably want to be more quantitative in our evaluation, right? Again, when we're talking about evaluating these different technologies, these different mechanisms, different technologies, they use different mechanisms. We're typically collecting different types of data to track their performance, but we'd still like to be able to compare that relative performance between technologies. So it can be really helpful to convert your performance estimates into common units. You know, we've got a few examples of those here. One that gets used a lot for a bulk mass removal as an example here is to compare your pace of remediation in the conventional natural source zone depletion units, right? So look at your mass or volume per unit area, per unit time. Kind of summarizing here, the technically achievable portion of the training, we want to consider each of our remedy selection questions, right? Keep in mind that just because we have LNAP site, it doesn't necessarily mean that hydraulic recovery should be, the first pick. Or should be implemented at all, really. Think about the questions, think about some of the different tools we've gone over that we can use to evaluate different mechanisms and determine which mechanism or, which combination of them is likely to be the most helpful in helping us get to our goals. So we're going to end the remedy selection LCSM here with a knowledge check. We've got a scenario here. We've got sheen on a creek. And while we're seeing LNAP on a nearby well, the transmissivity is pretty low. So we want to know, should we consider LNAP recovery as a component of a remedy for this site? Do we want to use LNAP recovery? Do we think it's likely to be part of the final remedy? and what other things could be done to improve our remedy selection. So, you know, as you're working through this, I think about, you know, I think it's very tempting to look at that low transmissivity and think hydraulic recovery is not our answer. That's reasonable, you know, given that transmissivity value, that's perfectly reasonable. But a lot of times we might consider implementing something like hydraulic recovery as an interim measure. It's something that we can put in place pretty quickly, something that we can use to prevent any further migration to the creek. And thinking about how that translates to part two of the question, be a different question, but
So Jonathan, I am broadcasting the results from the first part of the question, and once you're ready to move on to part two, just let me know and I'll open it.
All right. Yeah, so I like this. I think, like I said, I was sort of like hinting towards hydraulic recovery could be considered as part of like an interim remedy at first. I think the main reason, like I said, is because it's something that you can do quickly and easily to prevent any further migration towards that creek, right? You can put a mass control on with a hydraulic recovery remedy pretty quickly. So that's part one. Let's see, what do we think about part two? Yeah, completely agree with the class on this one. I think, or at least with the majority. You could certainly make a case for continuing. It's going to be a very site specific thing, but more than likely, we'll be able to find a more efficient way to address this than pumping into perpetuity. For the final question. What do we think? Do we think we've got all the answers? We're good to go. Can we do some things to help us make a better decision? All right. I think the biggest takeaway is that nobody answered that we're good to go, which is, I think, the most important part of this, because I do think it's, you could make a case for doing any of these other evaluations. So great job. And with that, I'm going to pass our presentation back over to Eric. He's going to talk about some additional discussion on choosing remedial technologies and identifying performance metrics and endpoints.
Great. Thanks, John. Thanks both John and Matt. Actually, obviously a lot of work went into the LCSM remedy selection portion of this presentation, and you guys did a great job presenting that. And it really stemmed from three broad questions. Where is the source? What is the nature of the source? And what is achievable for a given technology? So now we're going to jump back into the decision-making framework. And at this point in time, we have performed our remedy selection LCSM. We've gathered the information that we need to, and we are ready to implement a remedy. This is essentially a reminder. Don't forget about making that SMART objective with both performance metrics and endpoints. Trying to figure out how to advance. Okay, there we go. So performance metrics, as previously identified, they are technology specific. They verify that a remedy is being effectively implemented. They allow for mid-course corrections based on what that data is telling us. And they help us track the progress towards endpoints. One thing I would like to point out in the web-based guidance document in Appendix A for every particular technology, we provide performance metric examples. So this isn't something that you need to entirely create in a vacuum or on your own. There are some good examples that are provided, with one of the examples being provided here of for bioventing, maintaining a specified minimum oxygen content in the targeted region to facilitate that aerobic biodegradation. Endpoints are also technology specific. We had that question during the first question and answer portion, sort of asking what is the difference between goals and objectives, where it says endpoints defined as, it can either be the LMAPL concern has been addressed, that would mean that the goal has been achieved, and or the practicable limit of the particular technology has been achieved, in which case we need to evaluate, are we going to transition to the next technology in the treatment train? Just a very simple knowledge check at the back end of this presentation, but which statement is true? Remedial performance metrics and endpoints are optional, are the same for every technology, or are technology specific and site specific? We'll give a little more time on that. I did just want to identify, I can't understate how important developing that SMART objective is, based on the fact that a lot of times ineffective technologies continue to operate because those performance metrics or endpoint metrics are not identified. So I don't know if we are good, Devin. Great, 99% are technology specific and site specific. And again, there are helpful examples that are provided for every technology in that web-based guidance document. So here is an example of sort of putting it all together. This is figure 5-2 from the web-based guidance. I'm going to focus on the third column. LMAPL is present in a well. I'm going to identify right now how the metric of transmissivity can kind of be utilized throughout the course of evaluating and understanding this particular concern. It can first be utilized to verify that the concern exists. If we measure the transmissivity and find it is above the recommended endpoint range for recoverability, and again, that was what Jonathan sort of unpacked how those numbers came about. But let's just say that we've measured the transmissivity and we've verified that LMAPL recovery is in fact a concern that we have based on the presence of it in a well. We then perform a technology evaluation. In this instance, dual pump liquid extraction was identified as a suitable technology. Well, we can again utilize transmissivity as a performance metric. We have baselined what the transmissivity is, and so we're going to implement this remedy, and either time-based or perhaps other factors-based, we're going to interimly measure what that transmissivity is. And ideally, we've identified as an endpoint, our remedial goal in this instance is to reduce the transmissivity to below that recoverability endpoint range. Doing all of that makes this a SMART objective in that it is specific, measurable, attainable, relevant to our goal, and we have time-bound the implementation of it. The next couple slides are just going to identify what we will be discussing in part three, which I believe is next week, but we're going to get more into selecting the remediation technology to achieve the remediation objectives and or goals. It's how do we do it once we have determined what needs to be done. Here is an overview of the screening process that is utilized. The first step is to screen the technologies based on our remediation goal. If you recall, we had identified those three broad categories of mass recovery, mass control, and phase change. That will screen a decent amount of the technologies that are considered useful in addressing LMAPL concerns. From there, we look into what is the nature of the source and what is the geologic setting. So we screen those technologies on the site geology as well as the LMAPL characteristics. Step three, at this point in time, you probably have a few technologies that you might be considering, but every site is specific. Performing a comparative analysis, which comparative analysis factors could be cost, could be time, could be access to the impacted area, could be waste generation. There could be green and sustainable components that are important to the stakeholders for a particular project. So performing that comparative analysis ideally gets you down to one or two more technologies that have sort of appropriately been vetted to really address the issue that we have. A critical step before simply implementing it is identifying what are the critical data needs associated with the technology. Again, those critical data needs are identified in Appendix A for every technology, but a good example of a critical data need may be pilot testing a particular remedy before taking it to full scale. And then the last step is, of course, to select the technology and identify the performance metrics and endpoint metric for that particular technology. So, kind of summarizing the decision making and technology selection, we encourage the use of systematic decision making process as identified. A robust LMAPL conceptual site model identifies your LMAPL concerns. Matt addressed that initially with the sort of tiered complexity of the conceptual site model. Some may be simple, some may need to be very complex. Once we have identified our verified LMAPL concerns, we establish the remediation goals to address them. We identify the right technologies to abate the verified concerns by taking it through that screening process. The LCSM is a parallel process to the decision-making process. It's something that we develop, but then as we gather more information, we incorporate it into that conceptual site model. And lastly, SMART objectives are certainly recommended, and they help lead us to project success, which is what we should all be hoping to accomplish. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tom Fox, who is going to kind of wrap up today's session prior to question and answer.
All right. Well, we're nearing the end of our second part. If anybody has questions, we've had a couple come into the queue. Now is your chance to type them in so we can address them as we wrap up here in the next few slides. So next week in part three, we're going to be, in part three, we're going to be working on our LMAPL remedies. And as part of that, we have a number of things we're going to be talking about. We're going to be discussing remedial technology groups, which is a very easy way to winnow down the selections that you have it would work for your scenario. We'll also introduce specific remedial technologies and provide a framework for you to select a specific technology to use at your site. We're going to be introducing ways to screen the technologies for use and also be looking at performance metrics so you can optimize your efforts and decide, as Eric has said, when to stop or switch to another technology. So this comes into the treatment train question that we had earlier. And finally, we're going to be going through a case study to demonstrate the use of these tools in a very interactive way at the end of the third part. For next week, I have a little bit of homework for you. I'd like you to think about one of your sites and what data you have available to go through a short remedy selection LCSM exercise to select potential technology mechanisms or confirm that the current technology you're using is really applicable and the best one to be using. We're going to be providing some additional insight on these technologies in part three, as I've talked about, which will help your evaluation along. So with that, Devin, I believe you can wrap it up.
Thank you, Tom. So with that, we will begin our second question and answer period of our training today. So if you have any that you haven't been able to type in, please get those in so that we can address them before the training ends. So first question, where does cost enter the equation for remedy selection or risks and objectives, or is it not considered?
I think that was something that Eric had answered.
Yeah, I can address that. And that was most recently in slide 87, where I kind of introduced what we're going to talk about in more detail next week. But cost really should be considered within the comparative analysis portion of the technology screening process. You don't want to rule out a technology immediately based on cost prior to evaluating the technologies based on the remediation goal, as well as screening the technologies based on the site geologic factors and LMAPL characteristics. But cost definitely comes into play.
Thank you, Eric. Next question. Can one of the presenters provide insight into the validity of a regulatory concern that when an in-situ thermal remediation system with SVE stops operating in overburdened soil, VOCs from NAPL can settle out again from the vapor form to deposit back in soil?
Yeah, I think that's a concern sometimes with steam-enhanced thermal remedies. I'm not sure if that's what you're operating, but it's basically like when there's sort of a condensation front, where you have warmer zones and things are being volatilized and partitioning into the steam, and then you sort of there's a term for this, like a NAPL bank, I think. it's sometimes referred to as. But as far as I'm familiar, that's a phenomenon that occurs mostly with a steam enhanced remediation. I think other technologies where like the fact that you're mentioning there's an SVE system. I'm not sure if we're operating like an ERH with vapor extraction. It's not as big a concern if you have good control over your source term there, if you've got it well bounded, but that is a phenomenon that can occur with certain types of thermal remedies, and maybe another one of the trainers can comment further, but as far as the validity, I do believe that is a real thing for steam anyway.
All I can add is, looking at the hydrocarbon chemistry is going to be very important. and you're going to need to get some references to find out at what temperatures you're operating in and what compounds potentially could come out of the vapor phase.
All right. Thank you, Tom and Jonathan. Next question. Can you comment on modeling tools selection for the LCSM design?
Modeling tools for the LCSM design. So I assume we're talking about what the latter half of the LCSM questions were. So basically the questions that are focused on remedy selection, evaluating different mechanisms, the three questions on where is the source, the nature of the source, and what can be achieved. And we talked through some of the tools or some of the thought processes you might go through. Don't know of a screening tool that would just sort of automatically set that up. But you generally want to look at the different ways of looking at those different mechanisms. Some of which we highlighted here today. Understanding those, being able to answer those three different questions satisfactory way is a pretty good starting point.
Thank you, John. Next question. Please explain the reason for the transmissivity metric range of 0.1 to 0.8. For what situations would 0.8 be applicable versus 0.1?
Yeah, so it is tricky. We kind of tried to touch on that a little bit today. The reality is that range it came out of sort of an empirical study, right? Really, it was this. There were a bunch of sites that were evaluated based on different metrics. So transmissivity wasn't part of the evaluation of these LMAPL sites, right? People were looking at, whether or not we had asymptotic recovery conditions, looking at the stability of the LMAPL bodies and the dissolve phase plumes, looking at risk to receptors. So based on these other lines of evidence, these were, a large group of sites that were granted no further action. And then upon establishing that there was, a large group of professionals and regulators that had agreed and come to a consensus that these sites did not require any further remedial action, or at least hydraulic recovery, we then looked at the transmissivities, the LMAPL transmissivity associated with those sites, right? And they fell out in the range of 0.1 to 0.8. So that's why it's a range, and the range isn't really supposed to convey that, if you're in scenario A, you should be using 0.8, and scenario B, you should be using 0.1. In reality, the sites that were evaluated there, most of them were either reduced to about 0.8 feet squared per day through active remediation, or in most cases, they started at transmissivities that were 0.1 or less. It sort of sets up this idea that 0.8 is a good endpoint metric, maybe, but in reality, transmissivities that are in that range all indicate that you are, that in most cases, most of your LMAPL is at residual saturation. So, I know that it's a good question. It's one that gets raised a lot, I think, because it's not satisfying to a lot of people to see that range. But the reality is, like I said, it came about through an empirical evaluation. most cases, an LMAPL transmissivity that's anywhere within that range is all it's telling you that you're mostly residual. So hydraulic recovery isn't going to be that effective anywhere within that range.
Thank you, John. Next question, related to the previous one. Is LNAPL transmissivity affected by the recovery method, for example, skimming versus vacuum assisted?
Yeah, it can be. I mean, some of that comes down to, for example, it doesn't even have to be necessarily like a test method or recovery method. You can do the same test method, and at different water table elevations, you might see different LNAPL transmissivities. So it all has to do with your LNAPL distribution and which technique sort of optimizes the recovery, the recoverability of the LNAPL that exists, right? So a lot of times dewatering will potentially give you higher recoverability. It's a good question. That said, in most cases, if you have a low LNAPL transmissivity, a lot of times you end up with modest changes when you apply different techniques. But again, that's very site specific.
John, isn't it fair to say though that the ASTM standard, if you look at the different ways transmissivity is calculated for different recovery techniques, in theory, the calculations are different to try to control for enhanced different types of enhancements involved in different techniques. So it's the idea is that it should be standardized in theory, but I think John is probably right in a reality standpoint. I think we would be naive to think that it would never make a difference.
Tom, did you have anything to add to that? I saw you.
No, I was just going to echo both what Matt and Jonathan said. So they said it very well.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, thank you, Matt and John. Next question. While conducting dual phase extraction, when NAPL transmissivity data cannot be obtained, how accurate or effective are hourly PID readings alone while trying to monitor NAPL recovery rates?
I'm not entirely sure why the transmissivity data can't be obtained. Does that mean that there's no actual liquid LNAPL? I mean, if that's the case, certainly looking at your vapor data is a good way of estimating how much you can what your recovery efficiency is with that mechanism. A PID is sort of a blunt tool to be measuring that. They consider using the PID in combination with some laboratory analysis of vapor samples. Assuming that what we're talking about is no liquid phase LMAPL to be measured during the test. PID readings can be helpful. I would use it as a sort of a helper to, like I said, maybe a laboratory analysis and a known, measuring your flow rate and your concentrations over time so you can actually calculate your mass removal rates.
Matt, did you want to add anything?
I was thinking along the same lines as John. Just if you're going to use a PID, you'll want to supplement that with at least occasional duplicate samples that you send to a lab to verify. You might be able to almost set up a calibration curve, with your PID readings and your lab results to see what's what. I think the harder thing sometimes is the flow part. I would say make sure you correct to standard conditions when you're calculating mass removal rates, because that's something I still see people not do a lot. But I guess the problem with using recovery rates as an indicator at all is that there's no agreed upon or accepted endpoint metric for that. Like there is with transmissivity, right? Like we're talking about the 0.8, for example. That's a number you'll see talked about a lot in guidance documents and whatnot, but you won't really see something that says, you know, if you get down to 5 pounds per hour, you can call it quits. So it's a good performance indicator to monitor progression, but it's going to be a little bit arbitrary with respect to the actual endpoint.
All right. Thank you, Matt and John. And with that, we will conclude our second answer question and answer portion for today's training. Thank you all to the attendees for asking your questions, and thank you to our trainers for providing answers. If you need any further clarification on the answers, or if you have any more questions, feel free to email us at training@itrcweb.org, and we will follow up with our trainers to get your questions answered. You are also welcome to follow up with our trainers directly. Thank you to our expert trainers for being here today and for contributing to this ITRC document. Special thank you to our participants. We appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedules to join us. Remember, we do archive our classes, so if you are unable to join our live classes, you're welcome to access the archived training courses on the CLUIN website. Remember, the third part of this LNAPL training is next week. No, it's not. Part three is March 3rd, I believe. Let me just pull up my list very quickly. Part three, March 1st, is the third and final part of our LNAPL training series. So with that, we will wrap up our class for today. And thank you all for attending, and have a wonderful day. Mm-hmm.